Yep, coming up tomorrow night, it's going to be a huge night at our great sponsors, Majestic Cinemas, for the Glen A. Baker Music Film Festival. And wow, what films he's got to show. The Blues Brothers, Woodstock, Purple Rain, Elvis, That's the Way It Is, A Night at the Opera, and of course, Bohemian Rhapsody. He's online now, getting ready for tomorrow night. G'day, Glenn, how are you?
Mate, I'm absolutely fine. Yes, I am getting ready. With a couple of the films that I wasn't all that familiar with. And one of them, the film company arranged a special screening for me of Bohemian Rhapsody, the new film about Freddie Mercury and Queen, in 2.5 hours, and it was just astonishing. So I've just got through with seeing that and being all revved up, because that's our opening night, and that's the one that I'll be talking most about sort of in my introduction to the festival. So yes, wonderful stuff. Like I said, about time they made a film about Queen. It was the one thing that just loomed large as being sort of, you know, something that had been ignored for a long time. And with a man called Rami Malek, they really found the right man to play him. Absolutely.
Yeah, Glenn. Look, a couple of years ago when they were touring the musical, I got to speak with Peter Freestone, who was Freddie's personal assistant.
Oh, yes.
And it's an amazing story. I think Freddie's mum and his sister, are they still alive too?
Yes, I believe so. And Freestone, actually, who you spoke to, was one of the consultants to the film, as was, of course, Brian May and Roger Taylor. And so it was in good hands. The filmmaker was not allowed to get away with anything. Not that I imagine he would have. But basically, there were all these people watching carefully who knew how it all unfolded. They knew sort of, you know, what the story was. And so that's what makes it so. Look, there's something, mate, about films about rock culture that only the Brits can make. The Americans just don't get it when it comes to rock. Everything has to be cliched and overdone. But with the Brits, they understand what, you know, sort of like, yeah, the rock lifestyle is all about. And they do it. They do it so well. I mean, you know, you feel like that you are actually gone back in a time machine and you are visiting with Freddie and the boys as of back then. And the scenes in the Wembley Stadium for Live Aid are just incredible. Because they performed for 18 minutes. That was their segment in Live Aid. And all 18 minutes are reproduced on the stage. You get every note they play. And so that's what makes it really exciting.
Glenn, how important in Queen's makeup and their popularity, how important was that 18 minutes?
Look, Live Aid, remember that Freddie had been away in Munich doing his solo career and being sort of, you know, pretty much led astray. And he had to come back and humble himself and beg to the band to be allowed back into the band. And that's something we tend not to know. I think Brian May was always going to say yes, but he made him suffer a little. And because Freddie, I think, was drawn to the fact that over a billion, almost 2 billion people were going to be watching this thing, and that Queen should be a part of it. But, and Geldof had to, in fact, squeeze them in. The announcements had been made on the bill. Queen wasn't on it. And Geldof had to come back and say, and we have an extra added attraction joining us will be. And So that's okay. But boy, I think they went on stage having not played for a couple of years, and with just that incredible sort of, you know, sense of purpose. Because with Freddie, everything was a show. Everything was drama. I mean, I was in Zanzibar once doing a travel assignment, and I remember walking past this old coral stone building, and the guy showing me around just said, Farouk lived there, Farouk. And I went, what, King Farouk? That doesn't sound right. He said, no, Farouk Balsara. I said, you mean Freddie Mercury? Yeah, he said, he born there on a kitchen table. And that's where he was actually born. And, you know, then he went back through India, where his Parsi parents lived, and then on to London, So he didn't arrive in London until I think he was 16 years of age. And he cocked various forms of racism. Like there's one scene early in the film where he's working at Heathrow and he's unloading bags from the airport from a plane. And one of the other guys just refers to him as, you packy bastard or something like that. And you realise that that was a very English thing which we never thankfully shared in. But basically that's how people were just dismissed readily in England at that time in the late 60s. So, he wasn't an accepted man. His family weren't viewed with all that, degree of importance. And so he felt he had something to prove. Anyway, so that will be the first film we show. And then, of course, we'll be showing the four-hour director's cut of Woodstock.
Oh, beautiful.
Well, it's incredible. For any baby boomer, and I suspect there's going to be a lot of them there. I mean, Woodstock was the film that... Look, the thing is, it was not the only rock festival at that time, but it's the one they made the film of. And that split-screen, then three-hour film, really was a groundbreaking thing. Suddenly, all of us who couldn't be there... And the only person I know who actually was there is my friend Marsha Hines, who ran away from home at 16 and hitchhiked to go there without her parents' knowledge. So she's the only person I know. Well, and Chip Monk, the voice of Woodstock, who lives in Melbourne for these days. And so, but for the rest of us, we just saw that film and we just imagined that we were there. We saw Santana doing their soul sacrifice at a time when Santana did not even have a recording contract. We saw Joe Cocker come out and do those strange, unnatural things with his arm, which turned him into a globe. And we saw some performers, and I think this is very funny, who weren't on the bill, who weren't actually at the time booked and paid for, but were wandering around as punters. And because the New York freeway or thruway was closed, jammed with traffic, and a lot of acts were late getting there. I mean, Chip Monk, as he told me, just would actually grab him in the audience and say, "You, get up on stage, play, we need you." And one of those characters was a man called John Sebastian, who many will know as the leader of the Love and Spoonful, and who would have a couple of years later a national hit with Welcome Back from the Welcome Back Cotter TV show. Well, he was just wandering around, and Chip Monk said, "Hey, you, come on, up on stage." And they put him in the film, and his career was remade. His career was absolutely remade by Woodstock. It's going to be... The film goes for 4 hours. I think if I got up and told all my Woodstock stories, it would take 4 hours. So I won't do all my Woodstock there. But what also we tried to do was to try and give a broad cross-section. So we also go on to include Purple Rain by Prince, which is the first of his four films, and it was the film that really did establish him as an important artist. When Doves Cry became sort of a global hit, etc. But then we have, Elvis, That's the Way It Is, because Elvis needed to be represented, and that was, I think, his 31st or 32nd film. I've just visited Graceland leading a tour group. And I remember I walked into a cinema on the Graceland site, and they actually were showing that along with Elvis on tour. And it reawakened my affection for Elvis and his dynamism and his integrity and all that stuff. And, there were just the Blues Brothers, anyone who's ever loved soul. And, of course, we've lost Aretha, we've lost James Brown, we've lost Ray Charles. We've lost them all, basically. But there we see them, and they perform so incredibly well. And just to show that basically everything has a beginning, and for a bit of light relief during the days of the festival, I've included the Marx Brothers, A Night at the Opera. Not necessarily a music film per se, but one of the great slapstick films of all time. Oh, and of course, it's Groucho. taking the, excuse me for the French, taking the piss out of opera, and that scene where they're in the orchestra pit, and they're just throwing things back with them. I mean, I speak to pit musicians at times, including ones who played in the recent production of Evita in Sydney, and I brought up that that film, and they know scene by scene, they know that film. Every pit musician who's ever actually sat there to play in a stage musical or an opera or a choir, or whatever, knows exactly. Yeah. So, like I said, I grew up loving the Marx Brothers. I grew up, Groucho Marx was to me, you know, what I wanted to be when I grew up, which was, you know, I mean, I don't think I wanted. Yeah, like I said, he was such an incredible character. So that's it. So if anyone's wondering why are the Marx Brothers appearing on a Glen A. Baker Film Festival, it's my indulgence. It's my, and you know what? I think everybody there will just crack themselves laughing and will just be so, it'll be a relief, particularly if you've seen 4 hours of Woodstock.
Exactly.
And, you know, 4 hours of Woodstock will be wonderful. Don't get me wrong. But I think that you're probably going to need something, you know, just sort of as a bit of an antidote. Is that the word I'm looking for?
I think it is, yeah. Glenn, a couple of things. You've evoked so many memories. You talk about Woodstock. I interviewed a lady who had a cafe here called Sharon, who was at Woodstock, and I started out...
You know one.
Great. Also, I interviewed a bloke here who went on exchange through Rotary in 1980 or the late 70s and was in Chicago, and they used to go down and watch the filming of the Blues Brothers. Which was so far behind. It was the biggest flop ever at the cinema and the biggest success for VCR. And also with Woodstock, 2 years ago, I got to be in London visiting my son, and I went to Jimi Hendrix's unit in Mayfair. It is amazing. Yes. If you love Hendrix, you've got to go and see that. And I've got to say, Glenn, I'm so old, I'm going to be here 30 years next year. And before I got into radio, I loved listening in the early 80s to you and Bob Hudson on a, I think it was Tuesday night, you used to do music trivia
Friday,
on the first
Friday
three...
Friday night. Yeah. and the ABC had never heard it. That was, like I said, in the very earliest days of Double J, but the ABC 2BL, as it was then,
yes,
had never heard anything as irreverent as what... We did the rock and roll trivia show, and before us was the Ted and Lex show with Ted Robinson and Lex Marinoff.
That's right.
And of course, and so we just made, no, in fact, hang on, I'm wrong. It was, the rock and roll trivia show was Sunday night, and my thing with
Was it a Tuesday?
It was Friday night.
It was Friday night. Now, the other thing is, what about the album you put out? What about the album you put out, Antipodean Atrocities?
Antipodean Atrocities showed our irreverence. We put a few Australian acts on, and one of them was not pleased to be there.
Was it Sir Robert Helpman?
No, Robert Altman loved it. Robert Altman thought, I mean, given that Robert Altman made surfing records anyway, I mean, he was quite prepared to be sent up. Now, the person who didn't like being referred to as an atrocity was Jimmy Hannon with his song, his song Beach Ball. And I had to get on the phone to Jimmy and say, mate, don't take it seriously. You know, we're just sending you up with love and with affection, you know. Yeah. And so he was okay. We had great fun doing that. Look, one of the nice things about my life is that I've been able to, over the years, basically just indulge my love and passion for music and for nonsense and for fun. I could have fitted widgets to wadgets on the GMH assembly line, as I've said. Oh. You know, who knows, we all could have gone down that road, but, you know, we all ended up, you went into broadcasting, I went into being, you know, sort of announcing and a zillion other things. We went and did things that were, you know, that attracted us because we loved what we were doing, and that was the generation. Remember, we were the generation, we were the baby boomers, we were the ones to whom... all this was possible. And if you don't get that feeling when you watch Woodstock, then you know, there is no hope for you, because Woodstock is, you know, well, it's every, when they march to try and stop the rain and they slide on their bums in the mud, and when they do all these things, and it was we were so naive and wonderful that we believed that we could change the world with our music. Yeah. It was terribly naive. We didn't change the world, but gee, we had fun trying, didn't we, mate?
We sure did. And Glenn, I'll take you back a little bit further too, with your work with Old 55. Now, Peter Bryan's dad lived here, and Peter's a regular visitor to the Mid-North Coast. Gee, Old 55, mate, that was just a great snapshot of our whole era.
It wasn't it, and you should have been at the heart of it like I was, in the middle of it. I mean, because it was something that both Coljo and Johnny O'Keefe once said to me about the 50s. They said, people think that we were the ones responsible for the madness that went on. He said, no. Both of them said, we got swept up in it too. You know, it happened to us as much as it happened to us. And that was the thing with the whole 55. Suddenly we're arriving in country towns and they're putting us in open-top cars, seven of them, me including the manager was included, and they would take us down the main street and there would be like hundreds of people waving and screaming and yelling and you know, sort of, we go straight to number one a matter of months after we'd first played our first gig in Sydney, and we knocked Best of ABBA off number one. I mean, that was the most incredible thing about it. So to be on the inside of it, and of course, when you talk about rat bags and lunatics, I mean, there was no. I mean, Frankie and Wilbur, bloody hell! I mean, they were. I remember we did a show at the Canberra Theatre once, and Wilbur set up a rope so he could swing out in the audience. The only thing is, he didn't bother testing the rope, and when he jumped on it, swung out into the audience. He got as far as row one or two and landed, bang, right in the lap of some poor woman. Now, I should point out that Wilbur is about 6 foot six and very large. And to have Wilbur land in your lap with a saxophone was something that nobody could have quite expected. But I think we gave her a ticket to another concert. We gave her a CD and a T-shirt, and she was happy. She limped off into the sunset.
Well, there you go. I guarantee Wilbur Wilde will not swing into the audience tomorrow night at Majestic Cinemas, but Glenn A. Baker will be on stage at 6:30 tomorrow. It's going to be a great night. A drink and nibbles on arrival. Glenn, really looking forward to seeing you tomorrow night, mate.
Mate, I'm having fun as well, because I think that, like, you know, and I encourage anybody who wishes to come up and ask me questions and all that stuff. It'll be wonderful.